Good morning. Good morning, Council. You may proceed.
Morning, Your Honors. Counsel for the State, may it please the Court. My name is Mike Wilson. I represent the interests of Timothy Britt in his appeal from convictions for 3 counts of felony murder and 4 associated counts. We're here because the source of the most damaging evidence during Mr. Britt's jury trial was a ghost by the name of Anthony Davis. I call Mr. Davis a ghost not because he's dead. He isn't. He's alive and well, but he never materialized at the trial in this matter. We never received an opportunity to cross-examine Anthony Davis. And instead, over our repeated objections, the trial court allowed Davis's girlfriend and other friends to testify as to all of Davis's post-crime, self-serving narrative statements he made, including his claims that Britt was the one who began shooting in this home and that Britt was trigger-happy, among a sort of other tales that he told. The trial court allowed at least 10 out-of-court statements, if you break them out into their respective pieces, by Davis, and it did so on the theory that they furthered a robbery conspiracy that was still ongoing. So,
should this somehow help the conspirator?
Right.
All right. Did the state offer it on any other basis, any alternative basis?
Not to my knowledge. The record is silent as to any other alternative bases that it was offered under. I know the state has on appeal argued a few alternatives, and we're willing to address those today as well. But at least at trial, I don't believe that anything was ever discussed in terms of an alternative basis for the admission of these statements. Now, Davis's obvious purpose, we believe, if you read the statements, if you look at the totality of the evidence...
Before you go on, before you slide past that, if there is an alternative basis and the judge overrules the objection, doesn't matter whether the state said it or not, the judge, if you will, the trial judge, would get the benefit of the existence of that alternative basis, correct?
I won't argue that point with you.
All right.
I believe that the law supports that analysis.
Okay. Go ahead.
I was just going to get to my point, which was that the purpose of the statements, if you look at the content of the statements, if you look at the circumstances under which they were made, Davis was trying to exculpate himself by placing blame for the shootings on our client. That's what the majority of the statements say, and
that really wouldn't be exculpatory, though, would it? But Davis just wasn't smart enough to know that when he made those statements, he also was convicting himself of felony murder.
Right. We're dealing with a declarant here who's a drug-dealing armed robber. So he's not exactly, doesn't have the sophistication, I would say, to know that by making these statements, he's implicating himself in felony murder. I think in his mind, when he's making the statements, I think it's a pretty good assumption you can make that he's exonerating himself. He's saying, I had nothing to do with this. Mr. Britt went haywire, he started shooting, and everyone's dead because of Mr. Britt. So that, I think, is an important point to make. And I definitely see what you're going for. In fact, that's an argument that was made in one of the cases I cited, but was ultimately shot down by the Illinois Supreme Court, which is that it didn't matter who the shooter was. When you've got a felony murder situation, they argued, well, that's harmless error. And the state's made that same argument in this case. They're saying it's harmless error because at the time of the shootings, you know, it didn't matter who was shooting. So when Mr. Davis is telling all these folks, all his buddies and his girlfriend, that Mr. Britt's the shooter, it doesn't matter. It didn't matter whether Mr. Britt did the shooting or Mr. Davis did the shooting. They're both guilty of felony murder.
Well, now the question is whether those statements are admissible.
And the other question is, can we say beyond a reasonable doubt, if they aren't admissible, that the jury didn't rely on them at all in reaching its finding of guilt? And that's prejudice, and we'll definitely get to that at some point.
What do you think was the significant evidence that established that Britt was one of the co-conspirators in the robbery that the jury would consider in making its conviction?
Okay, so we're going to argue, by the way, that under And I want to answer your question. Before I get to it, I just want to make clear that our position is you've got to have two conspiracies in order to get these post-crime statements in. You've got to have the conspiracy to rob, and then you've got to have a crime that occurs because of that. Then you have to have a post-crime conspiracy to conceal. Now, as to the conspiracy to rob, I'm not going to stand here and argue that there wasn't at least some evidence introduced through the testimony of these witnesses, regardless of how incredible we believe they were.
Didn't Logman describe what was the conspiracy as well?
There was a guy named Logman.
Or Logman, you call him, okay.
Right, he was one of the meth dealers.
He was actually a co-conspirator.
Right, and he was part of the conspiracy. And he said that these two women that were driving around were part of the conspiracy as well, and they knew what was going on. The women denied it. So there was a lot of finger pointing and
Did he testify that Britt was involved in the scoping out of the place, and then it was his understanding that when he left that they were going to go on then and complete the robbery or attempt the robbery of the place, and then contact him later because he was going to get some of the proceeds?
That's true.
And wasn't there evidence that Britt then did go to this place and left the car with Davis? Is that the best evidence to convict Britt?
I'm not sure about that last part you said. I know that Logeman testified that he had an agreement. He was going to share, like, I think 25% of the proceeds from this. There's dispute, actually, in the testimony over who went and cased the place. There was one of the women said it was Britt. Another person said it was another guy by the name of, I believe, Mike Jones, or Mike, at least, a different guy. So there was a lot of confusion on that side of it.
There are really only two people who knew what was going on inside that house at the time of the robbery. One of them was Davis, who was subsequently convicted of felony murder, and Britt. And Davis didn't testify. But Logeman did testify that he was part of the conspiracy and that Britt was one of the co-conspirators.
That's a fair recitation of the evidence.
From that evidence, could the jury then convict Britt of the murders?
Just based on Logeman's testimony, even eliminating Davis's hearsay? Is that what you're limiting it to?
Well,
whether it could survive a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence, probably not. But at this point, if those statements that came in were technically inadmissible, then it's a whole different standard.
I understand.
Well, let's look at that at a different vantage point. Why isn't it harmless error?
Okay, there's several reasons. The first being that particularly as we get further and further out from this crime, the statements became more and more detailed and more accusatory toward our client. Especially, there's a couple of statements that the state actually concedes didn't fall under the co-conspirator exception. There's a series of statements made to Tiata Clairde, who was Davis's girlfriend, in which he basically gave a detailed blow-by-blow account of what allegedly happened in this house and very clearly put the blame squarely on Britt. There's another statement to Logeman that happened several days after the offense in which Davis says he's worried about a gun that was left in the house. A gun was recovered in the house. So in those circumstances, I believe what you have are pure narrative. Okay, the state concedes that, and those statements were, I believe, integral to the state's argument, if you look at its closing arguments, and integral to the state's theory.
They're not cumulative of anything that was previously said in other items of hearsay to the effect that Davis says Britt's the shooter.
There was one statement, I will grant you this, Your Honor, there's one statement in which, and this was in around 11:30 to 12:30 the next day, where Mr. Davis is speaking to Mr. Logeman about the fact that everything went wrong. And he says something to the effect of, 'cuz started shooting. during that statement. However,
why wouldn't that be part of the continuing conspiracy? Because Logan would want to know when he was going to get his cut, and as a part of that conspiracy, Davis says to him, "You're not getting any cut because everything went wrong, and Cuz started shooting, and we didn't get anything."
Well, first of all, I'd argue that, you know, you get there, you get to the point where he knows that he's not getting anything simply by Mr. Davis telling him everything went wrong. And I believe the trial court has a duty to parse these statements out. We objected to that entire statement. And the trial court did nothing to parse these statements out.
Could he say something to Lozman why that would still be in furtherance of the conspiracy, even after it occurred, by telling Lozman, "You're not getting anything"?
They've cited a couple of out. There's one out-of-state case. They cited one federal circuit case from, I believe, the 11th Circuit that says that that could be considered a co-conspirator statement in that it's updating a co-conspirator as to the status of the conspiracy.
Okay.
But again, I feel as though you could accomplish that without allowing in Cuz started shooting,
okay,
especially when we don't know who Cuz is.
What about the statement where Clarity asked Britt, "Have you got anything you shouldn't have?" And he produces a .22 pistol.
Her observations of him handing over a pistol are admissible.
You agree that's admissible?
I don't have a good argument as to why that wouldn't be admissible. And it is. It's evidence that does not help our client. I'm not going to suggest that there's no evidence here at all that inculpates our client. Clearly there is. However, you don't, to get past the standard that they need to get past now, meaning the state, you've got to show beyond a reasonable doubt that especially these later statements, the ones that are detailed, the ones that talk about a gun being left, the ones that talk about Britt being trigger happy and going off and just shooting people while Davis is innocently, you know, searching a room.
You're arguing that can't reach the harmless error.
I can't see any way in which you can argue that there's... You have to find, essentially, that there's no way the jury relied on that, or, you know, it's surely unattributable to that testimony, their verdict of guilt. Surely unattributable is a pretty high standard. That's your language, Your Honors. And I can't...
What about the state's claim that, in an alternative, that Davis's statements were an excited utterance and therefore would be admissible under that exception to hearsay? Because he was still under the stress of the event.
I'm glad you asked that, because that was one thing I didn't get to in my reply.
But was that an objection that was, or was that a theory that was advanced at trial?
Not to my knowledge. I don't remember.
It wasn't
that
fully
record.
Developed it on the record.
Whether it was an excited utterance?
Yeah.
No.
I don't think
that
the state
was
offered it on that basis. They're arguing it in their brief, but I don't think that was offered that way.
Not at the time, no. I mean, they're arguing essentially to say that it's harmless because it could have come in under that. And, you know, my main point on that, Your Honor, and I'm glad you asked it because I just ran out of space in my reply, but these statements, the ones that they're arguing should come in under that excited utterance, occurred hours after the event.
Well, they occurred when he went back to the house, didn't he? And he's rambling around in the bathroom and then telling them that you shouldn't get close to Mont, and things went wrong, and it's bad, and things happened that weren't supposed to happen. That was pretty soon after the event, wasn't it?
Hours. I think it's far enough removed that this court could certainly find he wasn't under the influence of the event such that his...
Well, the trial court certainly wasn't even given an opportunity to make a finding.
That's true. It would have been nice, I mean, if that's what they wanted to do, they could have tried it, I suppose.
Okay.
And if this case is remanded, they'll have an opportunity to do that.
Why don't you move on with your argument?
All right. So, I want to get down, I'm starting to run out of time already, unfortunately. I want to get down to the underpinnings, if I could, and I'm going to get theoretical on you, sorry, but that's part of what we do, right? In the Supreme Court, is we talk about the logical underpinnings of these rules. And if you go back to Justice Blackmun in Borgeli, which is one of those seminal U.S. Supreme Court cases, he said that, and I'm going to have to read this because I can't remember all of it, the logical underpinning of the co-conspirator exemption from the hearsay rule is that co-conspirator statements are supposed to be inherently reliable because active co-conspirators have, and this is the quote, no incentive to misdescribe the actions of their fellow members. So in other words, we can rely on these statements because these guys are all in the same boat. But what the evidence and all the circumstances show, I'm really oversimplifying it, I know, but what the evidence and the circumstances shows here is that Mr. Davis jumped ship immediately upon the return to this home when they're arguing, he's calling his girlfriend to come get him, there's a lot of blame being thrown at Mr. Britt. Any chance he's out of earshot, he's telling anyone that'll listen, it's Mr. Britt. Mr. Britt did this. He did it. And so what I'm saying here is that he's immediately motivated at that point by his own self-interest. There's no more mutual interest there, or if there is a mutual interest, those particular statements are not in furtherance of any mutual interest. They're in furtherance of Mr. Davis looking out for Mr. Davis.
They're not explicitly in furtherance of the performance of the crime.
Of the robbery?
Right.
Absolutely not. And that goes to that whole question of, does the state have to prove a subsidiary conspiracy by prima facie?
At some point, the crime is over.
Exactly. It terminated when they ran out of there.
Let me point to you a statement we made in Gutierrez that said it's well established that statements made by a co-conspirator in furtherance of avoiding capture or punishment are made in furtherance of the conspiracy within the meaning of Rule 801. How do you distinguish that statement from what you're arguing here?
So in Gutierrez, the court said that, could you repeat just that part that you said that?
Yeah, that the statements made by a co-conspirator in furtherance of avoiding capture or punishment are made in furtherance of the conspiracy within the meaning of Rule 801. Mm-hmm. I know the federal courts probably don't agree with that, but we did make that statement in Gutierrez.
You did, but you're going to have to clarify, because in State v. Watson you also said that it's prejudicial error to admit incriminating and inculpatory extrajudicial declarations of a co-conspirator made without the knowledge of the defendant after the conspiracy ends through termination by failure or however else it might terminate, success, failure, whatever it might be.
I mean, your argument then is that the statements that Davis made, even if they were made to cover up the crime, they were not admissible because they weren't exceptions to the hearsay because the conspiracy had ended and these statements were made then after the robbery, botched robbery, was over.
Right.
So it wasn't made in furtherance of the conspiracy.
Not of the robbery conspiracy. They have to give you prima facie evidence of an independent conspiracy.
You would agree that if Davis were conspiring again to cover up the crime by moving the witnesses somewhere or hiding them, or you've got to get out of town. But didn't he say that in some of the testimony, that you've got to get out of town or get away, I don't want you around Mont, because the inference is Mont may want to kill you to eliminate you as a witness?
That was to Branch and Jones, and that was many hours after the robbery. And essentially there, he's again placing blame on Britt, saying Britt's dangerous, Britt's going to hurt you, you need to get out of here.
But you don't think that arises?
I don't think
that becomes a subsidiary conspiracy.
I don't think it shows a subsidiary conspiracy because there's no independent evidence of a subsidiary.
Evidence that he's conspiring with anybody else, is that right?
You need that independent evidence that he's agreed with Britt. Otherwise, they're not co-conspirators. I might save a minute and a half.
Excuse me, it's not between co-conspirators.
Right, not statements between co-conspirators, statements of a co-conspirator. Correct. Thank you.
You may proceed. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the appellee, the state of Nebraska. The sole issue on appeal is whether the district court erred in admitting certain statements by Britt's co-defendant, Anthony Davis, under the co-conspirator exception. Now, the test for admitting co-conspirator statements is well established. Statements must be made both during the course and in furtherance of the conspiracy. It is the during the course part of that test that is primarily primarily at issue here.
Well, do we follow, is our rule similar to the federal rule on 801?
It's similar. The evidentiary rule is similar, but the court has never actually passed on that. And I think the U.S. Supreme Court noted in Dutton that their reasoning for adopting the approach that they took was tied up with their substance of law of conspiracy, which would be 18, Section 371.
Okay. So you're relying upon some of these statements that were made by Davis and the co-conspirator.
Right.
I think the record would establish that. Were these statements offered before there had even been a conspiracy established by independent evidence?
No. I mean, Logan, in Gutierrez, the court kind of addressed that issue. And by virtue of Logan getting up and taking the stand and saying, yeah, here was the agreement.
That's prima facie evidence of a conspiracy, so.
Right, not the overt act. By the residents in case.
What I'd like you to tell me is, what is the state's best argument on the evidence that was offered to show that Britt committed the allegations as charged?
I think the case,
without the co-conspirator statements.
Well, actually, that is set forth in pages 33 and 34 of my brief. My harmless error analysis assumes that none of these statements come in. So if you extract all of the statements that are being challenged here, that is all of the evidence that you have that's linking.
And that's on page 34. What is that evidence?
Well, they're basically, they picked up Britt. They had the agreement to commit the robbery. They pick up Logeman. They pick up Britt. They go over. They do the drive-by. They take Logeman home. Then you've got Britt and Davis going back to Branches and Jones' residence.
No, you don't know that. They left and went in that direction. That's about all you know from the statements of the people that were in the car.
No, this is before the murders.
Before the
this
what?
This is before the murders.
Okay. Well, right.
So they went, they did the drive-by, took mm-hmm. Logeman home. They go back to Branches and Jones's residence. This clearly isn't a social gathering. These women don't know Britt. He's not talking to them. They knew that they were going there to wait on somebody. And then they waited there until Davis came in and said, okay, we can go now. The guy's home. So at that point, they all get back into the van. They drive back to the 9th and Bancroft area where Davis and Britt both get out and they start walking toward Avalos's residence.
Walking that direction.
Right. They're walking in the direction of that residence, and then Davis comes back 5 to 7 minutes later. He's not saying anything. He's not talking. He's kind of clammed up. And then Britt comes back later, and I believe it was Branch that testified that he's wearing gloves. He's got a bandana on. He gets in the car. He asks him if they heard anything. Keeping in mind, of course, that you know there were just several gunshots fired in a residential area. And so they go back to Branches and Jones' residence, and of course that's the point where Davis and Britt are arguing. They're having some sort of a discussion. We don't know what that was because no one else was privy to it. So, but then they call Claraday. She comes and picks him up, and that's where you have the beginning of the additional acts of concealment where you're getting rid of the gun, you're changing your clothing, burning gloves on a grill, and then eventually Britt's taking up residence later that same day with Branch and Jones. They don't even know the guy.
At what point does the conspiracy for the robbery stop and then the subsidiary conspiracy to conceal start?
Well, our position is that it's just one continuous conspiracy, that you don't have to show a subsidiary agreement. Because if you show, that's the problem that I have with the federal rule, frankly, is it's a line in the sand. They say once the main objective is complete, that's it. I mean, acts of concealment would be admissible, but any declarations are out. And, you know,
Are you relying then on our statement in Gutierrez that's a continuation of the conspiracy is the participants' actions in concealing the crime?
Well, I think Gutierrez is the closest that this court has actually come to addressing that particular issue. The problem there is that it wasn't the during the course of that was the focus. It was the in furtherance language.
What did we say in Bobo about it?
Excuse me?
What did we say in State versus Bobo about a conspiracy?
I remember the case. I don't remember specifically. Reiterated the rule itself. I don't think that during the course.
Well, did we discuss when the conspiracy ended? That the conspiracy ends when the act is done?
Well, then that's the question. That's before the court, and that's my point, is when is it?
Well, you'd never have, in other words, any conspiracy then would never end as long as the robbers weren't caught.
Well, I mean...
Because they're always trying to conceal what happened.
Well, and that's just it. It's like the, what they say is, and even the U.S. Supreme Court has acknowledged that, look, this is a natural... Concealment is a natural and integral part of every conspiracy, but they're saying, you know, it doesn't count. And not only does it not count, you can't prove up a subsidiary agreement circumstantially. So the way that I read Grunewald is essentially, unless you have direct evidence of an express agreement between these people, which in this case I clearly do not have, you're out of luck.
Yeah, okay.
There's nothing there.
And the question is whether or not we have to follow the federal rule or we have an exception to that.
Right. I believe that you can, I mean, it's basically there are policy decisions involved. The Supreme Court has come out and said, look, you don't have to do that. You can do what you want. And they, and actually the issue or the rule that was issued there was in Georgia, and they seem to take a very broad view of conspiracy, and I think their rule actually has concealment phase in it. And the rule there is that as long as the conspiracy, that the criminal project is still pending, so long as the conspiracy to conceal the fact that a crime has been committed or the identity of the perpetrators continues, so that appears to have that very broad, seemingly indefinite. But there are other states that have taken, you know, narrower approaches. For example, Illinois has determined that efforts to conceal are admissible, but only if they occur or are undertaken within the first few days after the offense was committed. There are other states like Minnesota and Tennessee that have declined to adopt a bright line test for determining when a conspiracy ends, okay. And instead they just make the determination on a case-by-case basis.
What about Davis's remarks about the robbery being botched and that things went on that happened that weren't supposed to happen, and Cuz got trigger happy? Are those statements made to conceal the robbery?
I'm sorry, what was the first one that you asked me about?
What were Davis's statements that the robbery didn't go, should have, things didn't go as planned, and because Cuz was trigger happy and they started shooting and...
Are you talking about the statements of Logeman about everything went wrong and Cuz started shooting? Because that, I argue, was part of the original conspiracy, and that, I think, under even federal law would qualify because it's an update to a co-conspirator, and I think that's fairly well established, even in the states. So I think that one would qualify. But as for the confession, the fuller confession that he made to Clarida a couple of days later, I'm having difficulty coming up with a reason why that would have been a conspiracy and not merely narrative. But my response to that, of course, one, it would have been admissible for another reason. But even if it wasn't, it's harmless in light of all of the other evidence that was properly admitted, including statements. And then, as I argued initially and in my harmless error analysis, even without them.
Well, why would, what other reason would this statement be included?
Or I think it's an admission against the alleged.
But
on behalf of Davis.
But it's... Okay.
I mean, even if it's... I mean, and there's case law out there, too, about dual inculpatory statements and when those... And if he's inculpating himself and he's making these statements, I think, of course, it's... And says, well, if you're inculpating yourself and somebody else... making those statements to somebody other than law enforcement, not where you're trying to shift blame or curry favor potentially, but if you're making those statements to a trusted confidant, like in this case was Clarida, we don't really have concerns about reliability. So I think those could be questions against penal interest. And the important thing there is, although it appears that maybe Davis was trying to say, maybe blame Britt for the shooting or whatever. He never said that he didn't do anything
well,
shooting, and he never denied responsibility for robbery.
Your penal interest argument is interesting, but did Davis know and does he have to know that these statements really are against his penal interest when he's trying to say or shift the blame to Britt?
Well, I think they are against his penal interest in the sense that he never denied involvement in the robbery, and that's really what all it takes to get him on the felony murder. He never told anyone, hey, I had no idea this was going on. He started this. I thought we were going to buy drugs.
Right.
I mean, all along he acknowledged that he was part of this conspiracy and that, yes, we did go there to rob, but he's just saying things went really wrong once we got there, and now these three people are dead.
Because Britt did the shooting.
Because Britt did the shooting.
But the evidence, when you look at the evidence that came in, it's obvious that both of them did the shooting because there were 22 and 40 caliber wounds to each one of the victims.
I think that's fair. I think that's one inference. I mean, maybe it's possible that Davis is telling the truth. Maybe Davis or maybe Britt had both of the guns. I mean, there is a marked difference in the demeanor of these two defendants.
The evidence really wouldn't give that implication, would it, when Davis was concerned about the Glock that had been left at the scene?
Right. No, and I would submit to you that I agree.
It indicates that probably Davis had the Glock and somebody else had the .22 because when he was asked later, Britt produced the .22.
Right.
My point is, does he need to know that he's inculpating himself by saying, I didn't do it, even under a felony murder, he would be equally culpable? Does he have to know that in order for these statements to be admissions against penal interest?
I don't think so, because he's still inculpating himself in the robbery. Okay. I don't think it necessarily has to be. We don't have to break it down into shooting at the robbery. If he's saying, I was in robbery, the statements are obviously against his penal interest, regardless of shooting. But as I was saying, with the other, there are other states that have adopted different tests. There's Minnesota, Tennessee, for example, take a case-by-case approach, and they consider a number of factors, including whether there was, in fact, an agreement to conceal, the closeness of time of the concealment to the commission of the offense, and the reliability of the statements, which we touched on a little bit earlier.
Does the state have to make alternative basis for admitting the evidence if it simply argues that this is a co-conspirator statement that's an exception to hearsay? Does the state, if it wants to offer it for some other reason, have to advise the court so the court can rule on whether or not this was in fact a statement against penal interest?
I think that would be optimal. That didn't happen in this case. It came in solely on the co-conspirator section.
Excuse me, I didn't hear you.
Oh, I said that I suppose that would be optimal, but,
is your argument you don't have to raise that in the lower court? You can raise it on appeal that even if it wasn't admissible as a co-conspirator statement, it's admissible as against penal interest of the co-conspirator?
If it falls under the exception, the hearsay exception, I'm having a little thinking of the co-conspirator statements in the statement against, party opponent statement, which is under 801, and the exception's under 804, but those are reviewed de novo. Exceptions to the hearsay rule on appeal are reviewed de novo, so I think if the fact supports it, the court could step in and say, we find the facts.
Haven't we, in State v. Dragasnew, said that if you argue an alternative theory, the person is wanting the evidence in has to at least raise it and make a record to give the other party a chance to rebut that or confront that?
That's true. But as Justice Castle pointed out earlier, I think the law is equally clear that if there's some alternative basis in which to uphold the court's judgment, we do that. I mean, I think part of that is judicial economy. Do you really want to
That may be on a right result, different reason, but right. not on an evidentiary issue.
Well, that's what I'm arguing is right result.
Yeah.
But in any event, when the question of when we submit that all of these, if you apply the rule of conspiracy, that it continues into the concealment phase, and the question becomes whether they were in furtherance of the conspiracy. As I've already conceded, there are a few of these statements that don't qualify. I think they were admissible for other reasons, but even if they weren't, their admission was harmless.
Because why? The evidence isn't all that thick, is it? Or
I think the circumstantial evidence against him is very strong, yes.
Yeah.
I don't think, I mean...
You mean the fact that he went there and was seen there and participated early in the casing of the place they were going to rob and then got out of the car and left and then came back?
Being taken there. And then, of course, the thing that happened afterwards, which I call concealment. Why is he ponying up the gun when he gets in the car with Claire Day and she said something you're not supposed to have, and immediately he gives her the gun and then they go.
Well, that probably isn't a hearsay statement, is it?
No, those are acts and those are admissible even under federal law.
So that would be evidence of his.
But it's evidence of a prior agreement. It's evidence of intent, and it certainly implicates him in the offense, because what is he doing getting rid of guns and changing his clothing and moving in with these women that he doesn't even know if he wasn't involved, in the robbery? There's no explanation for him other than his participation in this offense. And that's why I think all of the evidence in this case points in the same direction. And it all leads to the inescapable conclusion that Britt was Davis's accomplice. And once you establish that both of them were involved in the robbery, then they're both liable for the murders, regardless of who did the shooting, whether it was one or both of them. is legally immaterial. And to the extent that Britt argues otherwise, we disagree. He cited, you know, the one case that he cited in support of his position, which is Illinois, the People v. Parmley case, is factually distinguishable. That case involved a felony murder in which there was some dispute about who the shooter was. But importantly for our purposes, that the defendant in that case actually took the witness stand. And he not only denied that he did the shooting, but he denied that he knew they were going there to commit robbery or burglary. So he essentially got on the stand and testified that he was an unwitting accomplice. And the court in that case determined that the admission of the improper statement identifying him as the shooter wasn't harmless because it could have potentially affected the jury's assessment of his credibility.
Yeah.
We don't have that problem here because Britt
didn't testify.
Exactly. And as
again, so in your view, then, without regard to the Davis hearsay, there's sufficient circumstantial evidence?
I believe so. And I believe beyond a reasonable doubt. I think you could safely say that it was surely unattributable to the
And basically, again, we're talking about 10 statements, aren't we, that were made by Davis?
Yes.
Is there any statement made by Logeman that's attacked as hearsay? Because he testified at trial.
He did testify, yes, subject to cross-examination.
And all the other, the two women who were waiting for the robbery to occur also testified.
They did, and so did the girlfriend who came and picked them up, Flaherty. So it was Branch and Jones were the two women who were involved taking them there. You had Logan who was involved at the front end of the conspiracy and again the back end, and then Flaherty who came in after it had been committed and was involved afterwards. So essentially what you have is you've got four witnesses, only two of whom know each other. They're all involved at various stages of this, both before and after the robbery, and they're all saying essentially the same thing. I think they're all implicating Britt, and I just don't see how you get to any other.
But Jones, Branch, and Flaherty got all their information with regard to what happened through Davis, right?
Well, I would...
Other than being in the car.
Yeah, Flaherty, yes. Branch and Jones, I think they, you know, their suspicions were aroused immediately. I think they had enough information. They kind of put it together, especially when they saw the newscast on TV, and they're like, they thought something was up at that point. So I wouldn't say that they got all of their information from it, and I think... You know, once you have Britt coming over there and them and essentially keeping an eye on them.
They have testimony as to facts. Right?
Well, they don't have any firsthand information about the robbery. Right. Particularly, they can testify that, yeah, he came to my house and been with me. Sure.
Is it your position that these statements by Davis were basically in furtherance of the conspiracy?
Some of them. I think most of them were.
But the one you argue that happened later on about his confession of what went on was admissible under a different basis as against penal interest.
Yes, I think it could have been. I think.
And that any of the other statements were harmless because there was enough evidence to convict without having the hearsay.
Right.
Tape.
Right.
If it was hearsay.
Exactly. And I would submit to you that even without if you take all of the challenge statements out, I think you're still left. Enough circumstantial evidence, tight enough, that you're going to, what choice do you have but to convict him? We know that there were two people inside the house, not only because there were two guns used in the offense, but also because Francisco, the eldest son of the victim, was in the basement. And he heard the footsteps overhead, he heard the guys on the basement, let's go, or on the basement stairs, you know, let's go, as he was on the phone with 911. So we know there were at least two people inside the home. And I think when you couple that, their return to the vehicle, seeing Britt with the antenna and the gloves on his hand, saying, did you hear anything? I think, circumstantially, I think it's very tight. So, for those reasons, we would ask that you confirm the district.
Okay. The circumstantial evidence in this case was anything but tight. All right, these witnesses were contradicting themselves over and over again, not just between themselves, but at their own testimony. They were impeached repeatedly. Flaherty said, I'm a diagnosed chronic liar, and I lied multiple times about Davis's involvement in this offense because I was trying to protect him. to say that the circumstantial evidence, that the credibility of these witnesses is unimpeachable, that this is a tight case, is just, I can't stress enough how much I disagree with that statement.
Don't some of these witnesses testify to statements that were made by Davis that would inculpate Davis in the crime?
All of the statements came through these four witnesses. And again, three of them, Logeman, a drug-dealing conspirator in an armed robbery, is, I guess, maybe the most believable of the four. The other three, he said that Branch and Jones absolutely knew what was going on, that they were going to share in the proceeds of this, and they were actually helping case other houses while they were out casing Avalos' house. So, again, I just have a problem with the characterization of the evidence here is tight. I mean, everybody was looking out for number one. And Branch and Jones are over here saying, I didn't know they were going to
rob anybody. Your position is that the conspiracy ends when the robbery's done and that there's no subsidiary conspiracy established after the robbery was over.
I don't believe you have sufficient independent evidence, especially given the totality of the circumstances of what was going on, especially with Davis, in those hours and days following the robbery, to say that he and Britt had an agreement as to methods of concealment. They were on their own paths at that point. Whether they were in the same car or in the same vicinity of one another, I don't believe gets you to the point of saying, oh, Britt was okay with this plan of pointing to him and saying, you're responsible for all these shootings. Like, that wasn't part of any conspiracy.
Can we infer that Britt and Davis were arguing about what to do with the two witnesses to the crime?
So Davis is...
But you're saying that doesn't amount to forming conspiracy to conceal the evidence, because even if Britt wanted to kill the other two people and Davis wanted to get him out of town, that wouldn't result in a conspiracy.
Sounds to me like they're not in agreement. If Davis is coming out and saying, he wants to kill you, I want to save you.
Okay, your time is up. So.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
That is. That concludes the arguments for today. Then the parties are excused and we are adjourned.